Commissioner Robinson.
I also have Kelly Hagan to my right, who is my legal policy advisor at the Bureau, who can also answer questions.
Thank you. I know we'll hear more later on, in particular from Representative Dwyer, and we will get back to this bill.
I also believe that Representative Margaret Carter would like to testify in favor of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on 3374 and open it on 2324, the work session on 2324. The civil commitment bill that we have before us.
Okay, we have from my mental health, we have Dr. Bray, and we have also Jill Murray earlier. I don't see him right now. I do not know who's here from the AG's office. I think maybe
we have somebody here.
They're supposed to be
here. Just to outline, I think we'll get to the one of what people may think to be the crux of this bill, although that's not my personal opinion, the commitment criteria. And we've had, well, I just want to inform everybody that I've had some discussions with mental health department and the AG's office in this area. I think if we look at section 5 of the bill, pages 4 and 5, this committee has received a letter from Mr. Crowmeyer's office, which was from Glenn Klein, which was addressed to Mr. Murray from Mental Health. I understand there's a representative of mental health and the AG's office here today, and I'd ask that those two people come forward. Again, introduce yourselves.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Don Bray, Assistant Administrator of the Mental Health Division.
And I'm Lawrence Young, Assistant Attorney General.
Dr. Bray, with your permission, since you sent or your boss sent this letter to us, may I just inquire of Mr. Young?
Yes, certainly.
Mr. Young, can you outline the information contained in April 8th letter to this committee?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The April 8th letter, which was addressed to Mr. Murray, talked about the constitutionality of the present language in Section 5 and, in essence, concluded that it would not withstand a constitutional attack. There are essentially two sets of standards which have been used by courts lately regarding civil commitment proceedings. The first standard is the federal standard, and in the Ninth Circuit, the case of Suzuki versus Ewan, a 1980 case, declared that a civil commitment statute which did not require the presence of imminent danger to self or to others would not withstand constitutional attack within the Ninth Circuit. The present language in Section 5 contains no such standard. There is another set of opinions which use different legal criteria. Those are primarily in state courts, and they basically use two different standards. They either want to find that the person represents a present danger to self or others, or sometimes property, or that the person has a basic inability to provide for basic care or needs. And a number of those court decisions have specifically rejected the Suzuki holding from the Ninth Circuit and do not require imminent danger. However, Section 5 of the bill, again, does not require either of those matters, and we do not think it has enough saving graces that it would withstand a constitutional attack. We have outlined a proposed alternative in the letter, and that alternative, which also incorporates changes to the definition of chronically mentally ill, is contained in LC 2324-3. And that sets out a little bit more specific criteria for the commitment of people who are chronically mentally ill and appear to be deteriorating rapidly. I'd be happy to go through those criteria if you want.
Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, to be committed under the alternatives proposed by the Department of Justice, you'd have to be chronically mentally ill, first of all. And the question is, what is chronically mentally ill? The LC-3 amendments define that as someone who is over the age of 18 years of old, is diagnosed by certain professionals, which are either psychiatrist, a licensed clinical psychologist, or a non-medical examiner who is certified by the mental health division. That person is suffering from a certain type of mental disorder, i.e. chronic schizophrenia, chronic major affective disorder, a chronic paranoid disorder, or other chronic psychotic mental disorder, other than those kinds of disorders that are caused by substance abuse. And then the proposed language also permits the mental health division to further define what a chronically mentally ill person is through administrative rules so that it will be more specific. That's the first criteria proposed by the Department of Justice. Secondly, there must be two commitments within the past 3 years, two involuntary commitments, which is similar to what is in Section 5. The person, third of all, must be exhibiting similar symptoms of the behavior that preceded their prior commitments, involuntary commitments. And fourth, there must be a reasonable medical probability that the condition of the person is such that the person will continue to physically or mentally deteriorate unless treated. And that, of course, implies that if it's the kind of condition where the person recovers by themselves, then they would not be subject to civil commitment under the proposed amendment. Taken together, we think that this amendment focuses on present conduct and past history to the point that they demonstrate that there is a substantial risk of dangerous conduct or an inability to provide for basic personal needs. Those specific things, i.e., substantial risk of dangerous conduct or inability to provide for basic personal needs, are not specifically mentioned in the statute, but we think that they are impliedly there through the language.
Mr. Young, the proposed amendment by your office, even that suggested language may not survive a constitutional challenge. Would that be a fair statement? I'm reading out of your letter.
Right. Mr. Chair, first of all, it depends on where the case against it is filed. Certainly, I think passage of this will invite a lawsuit. If it's filed in U.S. District Court, i.e. in the federal courts, any U.S. District Court in Oregon is going to feel, I suspect, bound by the Ninth Circuit holding, which means you're going to have to go at least to the Ninth Circuit and possibly to the U.S. Supreme Court if it's filed in Oregon, in federal court. If it's filed in state courts have specifically rejected the Ninth Circuit holding, and there we think that there is a substantial chance that it would pass constitutional muster. We would not have proposed it unless we thought that it would pass such a muster. Now, as far as challenging the federal standard of imminent danger, that's certainly something that I think needs to be looked at, and the Ninth Circuit holding, I do not believe, is widely followed by other circuits in the nation, and I suspect that it might be worthy of Supreme Court review. Certainly, the nature of the change in psychiatric and psychological studies is such that people are using different standards now and are recognizing in greater depth the nature of mental illness.
I have one further question. Who would have control over where these cases are filed if a lawsuit is filed?
The plaintiff would have control. The plaintiff could pick state or federal court.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both. Did you have anything further to add, Dr. Bray?
Yes, you also requested a panel of experts to discuss from the medical point of view these criteria in terms of medical probability and the symptoms, the prodromal symptoms that are mentioned here. So I also have some people here from the medical school if you would like to.
We appreciate that fact, and if you wish then to put that in the record here on exhibiting the symptoms or behavior, Then why don't you have those witnesses come forward? That's what you're speaking to, the proposed amendment. Please go ahead, Dr. Bray.
Thank you. I would like to introduce Dr. Joe Bloom, who's chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the Oregon Health Sciences University, and Dr. Mike Resnick, who's a faculty member at the Department of Psychiatry.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I wanted to give some testimony based on two areas. One is clinical experience, having run the crisis unit at the University of Oregon the last 11 years, where we see approximately 700 new admissions each year, and also based on a very brief review of the relevant literature, which I'm going to attach and allow you to see. The fact is the majority of the 700 new patients I see are not new at all, but are returnees to the crisis unit because they have chronic mental illness, predominantly schizophrenia, and they relapse periodically. The tragedy is that this system perpetuates this failure, hospitalization, brief stabilization, and then failure back, returning to the crisis unit. I've seen some people 20, 30 times. And this does not include other hospitalizations at state hospitals and other institutions in the Portland and other areas. The thing is that this is unnecessary. We get to know patients and families get to know patients very well. Clinically, I can look at somebody and say where in the stage of their illness and their relapse they are. I know them well enough. And certainly by the time they've had two hospitalizations under the commitment process, their pattern is established. The first sign of relapse is usually stopping medication or severely reducing the dose. Often this is because the patient believes that he or she no longer needs the medication and can get along without it. A second factor, and one that I think needs to be acknowledged, is the majority of patients these days also either abuse drugs or alcohol. It's very unusual to see pure mental illness. Drugs and alcohol are ubiquitous in our society. One of the signs of deterioration is return to substance abuse or the addition of substance abuse. Then there's just this script that everyone can describe, the family, the physicians, the case managers in the mental health department. They can tell you what's going to happen next. It's not that subtle. First, they're kind of vague symptoms like changes in sleep patterns or appetite, activity level. Either they become more active or less active and just stay in bed. Then their psychological symptoms begin to reappear or intensify. This can be vague symptoms with thinking, problems concentrating, problems following the train of a conversation, but they soon become psychotic symptoms, hostility, suspiciousness, ideas of false beliefs or hallucinations. And their moods change. They become unhappy, dysphoric, and anxious. At that time, it's invariable that if in the past they've displayed dangerous or self-destructive behavior, that's soon to follow. Now that's the clinical aspect. The research has clearly shown that if you intervene early, when these prodromal signs, the anxiety, the sleeplessness, the trouble concentrating appear, if you start the person back on their medication, you can usually abort the process. The progression downhill will stop. The sooner you begin this treatment, the sooner you reinstitute the medications, the more effective it is, the shorter the time that the person will need to be hospitalized, and the less medication that will probably be needed for the shorter period of time. And you spare the person the danger, the embarrassment, and the loss of self-esteem that this process invariably has along with it. Now you can decide where you set your point of intervention. You can decide to wait just till medication is stopped. You can decide to wait till the early symptoms occur, or you can decide to wait till psychotic symptoms occur, depending on how imminent you want to get to the dangerousness. But the pattern is clear. I think anybody associated with that particular individual can tell you what the course of symptoms in that individual is and will be. So in summary, I'd just like to say this: the research clearly shows and the clinical experience clearly shows that in patients whose course and histories are well known, such as those described in this bill, we can medically reliably predict what will happen next, and we have adequate and therapeutic means to intervene in this downhill process. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll just take a few minutes to amplify some of the things Dr. Resnick said. This is, I was just sitting here thinking, this is now the sixth session in a row that I've testified to on one degree or another on some aspect of civil commitment. What I've prepared for you in that testimony is a general overview of the fact that we are now seeing nationally a reevaluation of civil commitment statutes, and that what we have proposed in this overall bill and in this specific section dealing with criteria is very much part of a national movement to try and move the balance between rights and needs a little bit back toward the center from where they have been in these original statutes, which were all passed in the early 70s, which ours was passed in 73. What I've reviewed there is basically some reasons why this has come about nationally, and I think that we have shared every one of the reasons I've listed on the first page: random violence, homeless people, criminalization, rise in advocacy, redefinition of mental illness, all of these things we've experienced here in Oregon. On the second page, I've set out for you, and I've included an article by two professors of psychiatry from Southern California, Richard Lamb and Mark Mills, an article on what they entitled Needed Changes in the Law and Procedure for the Chronically Mentally Ill. And I've listed six areas that they felt needed to be changed. I think with House Bill 2324, we would come a long way to getting about three of the six areas that they have listed there in somewhat of a meaningful form for us. Now, specifically, just a minute on the criteria. I believe the criteria as amended, recommended by the Attorney General's Office, are workable from the point of view of psychiatry and other mental health disciplines having to make these determinations. I think that you should know, and I'd like to emphasize, that the recommendations made originally in the bill and the changes recommended will be, if passed, the absolute most specific criteria in this deterioration area in the United States. This will be the most specifically targeted to a population, the least vague from the point of view of vagueness and other areas dealing with deterioration. States have already passed bills which are much, much less specific than we're proposing here. I think the specificity of this bill is something we should all be proud of. It targets a very, very seriously ill population. There's no question about that. They're workable standards. I think we can make the statute work, and I would urge your consideration of it. I think just one other point that I think I'd like to emphasize to you. We have conducted over the years many studies dealing with civil commitment. I think from the point of view of the specificity of these particular criteria, we will be able to very clearly tell you and other interested people 2 years from now what happens in this area. Because these are, as I said, very, very specific statutes. And I think we'll be able to follow people who are committed under this statute and kind of see what happens to them in relationship to their prior course, their prior history, and in relation to others where this isn't available for them.
Dr. Bloom.
Yes.
You're referring to the proposed amended criteria?
Yes. Yes, I'm speaking to the amended criteria. They are very, very targeted criteria.
Questions of these witnesses? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. On the criteria, I just want to
comment that we have the legal opinions of the main proponents of the bill here. It's not my purpose or intent today to accept a motion that will change the criteria from the way it presently exists. Nor is it my opinion, based on any of the language that I've seen, including the AG's letter, that any of that criteria will withstand constitutional challenge. And I've not yet seen language that will. And I, if there are members of the committee that differ with me on that, or that want to deal with that issue at this point, let's do it now, because we got other parts of the bill to move on to, and maybe some of the people here, maybe a lot of the people here are interested in that issue. I am not saying that issue is dead within the bill. I'm saying that I've seen no language that I know of that would withstand constitutional muster.
Chair.
Representative Dix.
Well, I share your concern. And the Attorney General's office stated that at least in one court, federal court, that this probably would be successfully challenged. And if I were a plaintiff, I would certainly look at filing in federal court rather than state court, given the testimony. The second problem I have with, and I've stated this before, all of this comes down to a question of money when you talk about the mental health problems, and there was nothing, although counsel for the Attorney General's office or the witness that spoke on behalf of the Attorney General's office did say they could defend it. I'm always curious at what expense they can defend something like that, which the phrase from when any office or agency comes to Ways and Means, the phrase from when they ask for money in order to continue defending a particular case, it just takes away from money that we could put into the area of mental health to help with the problem. So I'm most interested in finding criteria that will fall within the guidelines of the constitutional question.
Let's any further comment on the criteria from committee members? Let's move on. I would like to deal with 2324, and I'm not going to recommend that it be passed to the main committee. There may be language available on expanded criteria that I haven't yet seen. But let's move on with 2324, the rest of the bill, and I think the rest of the stack you have before you, committee members, would relate to the bill. What I'd like to do is to go through and listen to committee members on where they want to go with different parts of the bill so that we can prepare to have this bill technically in adequate order the next time we bring it up for work session, to move it on to full committee and then down to the Ways and Means process. With that, the way I intend to do this is to walk through the bill, and we may as well start at the beginning, walk through the bill section by section, and listen to committee members on where they want to go and just analyze the bill in that form. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bellamy.
Before you do that, can we have a listing of who all of these amendments are from?
Sure, if I can. Some of them I don't know where they're from.
Yeah, Mr. Taylor, yeah, that'd be great.
The first one I have before me is Association of Oregon Counties. It's this one right here. They submitted today.
Well, one moment now. Let's get everybody in order and have them before them so that you can go through them with every one of us.
Sure.
Okay. You got that one, Bill?
Right.
County.
This one right here. Okay.
That one says so.
Yeah.
What it does is it relates to the expense of providing counsel during hearings, and it would take the counties out of that. And, part of this combined with other amendments would bring the bill back to where it currently is as far as shifting of costs. It would bring it back to current statutory law. I'm now looking at House Bill 2324-1. This amendment relates.
Who's?
I do not know. I don't know what's been. It's been submitted by. I got a copy of it yesterday, but I do not know whether any member has submitted this to us.
Well, let's then just wait for that member to speak to it, or not spend our time on it. I mean, I'm sure that it will be moved if it's a part of it. But you got to have a sponsor.
We don't know who sponsored -1.
Unless somebody on the committee speaks up, I don't.
Anybody in the audience know?
Mr. Chair, that's John McCulley, Oregon Psychiatric Association. We had that amendment drafted.
Okay. Thank you.
I have House Bill 23-24-2. This is an amendment I received from Legislative Council. I called them just a while ago to ask who was the sponsor, and they said it was a member, but they couldn't, in keeping with their policy, could not tell me who.
Okay.
So unless some...
Proceed. Okay. Proceed.
Okay. House Bill 23-24-3. This relates to expanded criteria and was requested by the committee. Twenty-three twenty-four dash four relates to the Indigent Defense Fund and was requested by the committee.
Relates to the Indigent Defense Fund?
Yes, I can explain it. What happens under the bill, there is a shifting of costs as it relates to examination, who pays for examination of a psychiatric examination. It shifts from the counties where it currently is now to the Indigent Defense Board. This amendment would shift the cost back to the county. It would leave the statute as it is, currently is.
Would I assume that the counties would just reverse this? The county amendment, the first one you talked about.
Yeah, the county amendments relate to three separate amendments, three shifts in the cost, really. One to the Attorney General, one to the District Attorney, and one to the county. They, in the bill as proposed, would be responsible for representing, I guess, the state, depending on where the proceedings were held and where the committed person was.
Counsel and Representative Bellamy, I think Representative Bellamy's question, and tell me if I'm incorrect, was just whose are these from? Because we're going to have to go back into the substance of each one that actually gets moved anyway. That was requested by the
committee.
-4 and it relates to indigent defense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. -5 was also proposed by the committee.
Relating to
district attorneys.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, would we assume the district attorneys would support this -5?
It was filed by the committee also. -6. This relates to the liability standard set forth on page 23. This was filed at the request of the committee. And that is all the amendments that I have.
That's all that I have before me. We have...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bellamy.
Now I got to try to find the bill in my file.
Okay, this was provided to us by Don Bray. Yes. That's a section by section now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bellamy.
The question and the theoretical question that I would ask is if we are not going to deal with the expanded criteria, is there any reason to spend time with the bill?
Yes. The answer to that is yes, and I would ask for a capsulized response, perhaps better than I can do it, in the form of a response from Representative Kopetsky, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Kopetsky, State Representative, District 33, Representative Bellamy. A lot of the media focus and certain interest groups do have particular interest in the expanded criteria issue. And it's unfortunately or unfortunately received more media attention than the rest of the bill. But I think that all of the other changes in areas that we draw your attention to in this bill are put together are as important, if not even more important, than the expanded criteria issue.
For instance,
I'd like to give me a good example.
Good example would be the access to medical records so that the investigators and the judges have enough information to make an intellectual decision as to whether an individual ought to be committed or not. The issue of whether the DA's district attorneys ought to be organizing the case and presenting the case so that the families aren't trying to put the case together themselves in determining whether there's sufficient evidence and sufficient